Good morning, everybody. My name's Gail. I'm an alcoholic. A little nervous. My sobriety date is April 14th, 2008. See my notes here. So, you know, I've always been told kind of talk about it, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So, here goes. So I am the fourth of five kids, and you'll hear as I talk, I'm not from Georgia. I was born in Texas. My dad was in the Air Force, and then when he retired, we moved to Massachusetts, where my mother was from and all her family was from. I was two. And so I don't really remember a lot about when I was growing up. My dad died when I was seven. He had a massive heart attack. And so my mother was left with five of us, ages 14 to 6 months. My younger sister, who was 6 months, there's 8 years between her and I. And I remember even before he died a little bit, there was alcohol involved. I remember some rip-roaring fights, and I remember a lot of fear. And you know, kind of after my dad died, and now in hindsight that I've been sober for a few years, I can really understand my mother more, you know. But she turned to alcohol. And I will say, you know, when you talk about family, the way I can describe my family and my mother's family, like, we're all very successful alcoholics. Like, that is what we succeed at. And everybody drank. You know, everybody drank. You would go to a family function, and it wasn't a family function unless everybody was smashed and there were fights and, you know, just the typical, right, Irish Catholic alcoholic family. And I can remember, you know, coming home from on the bus and just praying, oh, God, please let her be up so the door is open so I can get in the house, you know. And some days were good and some days were not so good. And she did the best she could. She really did. And myself and my brothers and sisters, you know, as teenagers, we all got involved with alcohol, some drugs, some more than others. I wasn't really big, in, you know, smoking pot or whatever, but I can remember even, I don't know, maybe 10 or 12, and I tell this to my kids, and they're like, oh, my God, that's not normal. But I can remember going to bed at night, sleeping in my mother's bed, and she had a cigarette and a beer open. And I can remember going to sleep thinking, oh, I can't wait till I can do that. I just can't wait till I can lay in bed and have a cigarette and smoke. There was everything about it, even before I tried it, I loved. I just loved it. And so I don't remember my first drink. I know I drank very young, and I know I drank very hard. Whenever I did drink, it was to oblivion. There was never, you know, never a time where I thought, I'll just have a few. I mean, never. It wasn't good unless I was completely wasted. And all I really wanted really was a normal childhood. Like, I wanted it so bad. And, I met my husband when I was 14, and his family is just, they're incredible. They're close, you know, they're Portuguese. My in-laws don't speak English, and they had everything that I wanted. I would go to their house. They lived about an hour from me, and I would think, oh, my God, they eat dinner every single night. It was just, you know, it was such a world unknown to me. So when I was about 16, I left the house. You know, things were really rough. And my younger sister, who was 8 years younger than me, I was basically raising her. And I was tired of it. I was going to be done. And, you know, it's not my problem. And I'm moving on. So I moved in with my brother for a little bit, and then finally, you know, my husband said, again, we were just boyfriend and girlfriend, and he said, why don't you move in with my sister? You can live with her, and, you know. So I moved in with them, and again, I was just struck, like, you go to bed at night and there's clean sheets and there's a washer machine. And I mean, this was so completely foreign to me. And I thought, God, this is what I want someday. I want to have this family. You know, I want to have kids and I want to be able to provide that kind of life and live that kind of life that I really had no idea existed. So I turned 18 in October. In November, we got married. That was it. I was going to have that life and it was going to be great. And you know, my husband, we've been married a long time now, and you know, God love him. He had no idea what he was getting himself in for. No idea what he signed up for. You know, we were young and we really didn't know, really anything, but I can remember we would go out and he would say to me before we go, please don't drink too much. Kind of keep a handle on it, you know. Go out and just, can't you just have a few drinks like everybody else? And that was, as we know, impossible. I could not anymore. If I had two drinks in front of me, and I was telling someone this the other day, and someone was getting up to buy a round, do you want a drink? I'd be, yeah. My husband would be like, yeah, you have two drinks in front of you. Oh, yeah, but I'm not going to miss this round, you know. And that was it. And I wasn't happy unless I had as many as I could in front of me, and I wasn't happy until they were gone. And if I didn't have one in front of me, I would go around to tables of strangers and drink their drink when they weren't looking. I mean, it was, you know, the whole thing. It was ridiculous. But, you know, at that point, I think I still had some, I'm not going to say control, but I knew enough that if I don't drink, I just can't drink. You know, if I went out and made the decision to have a drink, all bets were off. But if I could say, you know, I won't drink tonight and go out and not drink, you know, I would be okay. I knew that difference, that if I touched it, I could not control it. So things went along good. You know, we have three girls, and I had gone just back and gotten my high school diploma, and then went to school to be a surgical technologist and work in the OR, and did all that and kind of was holding it together pretty good when the kids were little. And then went to nursing school. But before I went to, well, probably right about the same time I went to nursing school, my youngest daughter was 10. And she was very, very sick for weight loss and, you know, bloody poop and a lot of things that, you know, I just knew weren't right. And so it took us quite a while to get a diagnosis, but she finally was diagnosed with Crohn's disease. And I can remember driving home from Boston Children's Hospital, and in the front seat, my husband's driving, she's in the back seat, and I'm crying, and it pops into my head, this is a good reason to drink right here. Okay, now if that's not alcoholic thinking, I can't say that that was the moment that it turned, but I remember when I look back now, realizing what alcoholic thinking was. That it was in my mind, I think, that it gave me permission to drink. That I had an excuse. So things kind of went along. I started nursing school, and nursing school soon became a way to get out of the house at night and to stop and buy booze on my way to class. And I don't know how no one ever said anything to me. I don't know. I mean, we're good at covering up what we want to cover up anyway. But things progressively got worse and worse and worse. I did pass, you know, graduate, pass my boards, and you know, started practicing in the operating room, and my drinking was really out of control at this point, to the point that the kids were, you know, crying, please don't drink, please don't do this, but, you know, everything was a scene. It was the drama, the whole thing that we all go to. And I became very good at hiding my drinking, very good about doing anything I could to get the booze. I lied, I cheated, I stole, I did whatever I had to do to get it. And, you know, I've said it many times, I I would get up in the middle of the night to have a drink to be able to go back to sleep. I would wake up with the shake so bad that I couldn't function. And I think one of the hardest things was that, you know, I'm a nurse, and so I remember, you know, in nursing school them saying, you know, it's more deathly to detox from alcohol than it is from heroin. Physically, it kills you. It can kill you. And I knew that, and I just couldn't stop. It was getting up in the middle of the night to drink, to go back to sleep, somehow getting into work, sometimes sober, sometimes not sober. I would go to work, and then the whole day just thinking about which package store am I going to stop at on the way home. And I make the analogy that when I first started stopping, I was mortified the first time I went to the register and they had my Captain Morgan's waiting for me. And I was like, oh my God, I am so embarrassed. To at the end of my drinking, I was like, damn straight, have it there waiting for me. You better have it waiting there, I'm going somewhere else. Like, that was just like the analogy of how my whole perceptions changed. And at the end of my drinking, I don't even know how I still had a job. At that point, I was a manager of an operating room, and I could convince myself that I wasn't affecting patient care because I was a manager and I didn't really have hands-on care, right? I was in my office all day. And so I really truly believed that I wasn't hurting anybody. So kind of went on my way, you know, the husband's done with me, the kids are done with me. I had at that point, I have 6 granddaughters now, but at that point I only had one, Cecilia, and she was really the light of my life. I mean, she still is. They all are, but my daughter was at the point that, you know, I don't want you with her anymore. I don't trust you. You drive drunk. You'll probably drive with her in the car drunk, which I was. And so she just was like, you know, I don't want you around C anymore. So things were really, really bad. And so on April 14th, 2008, went to work and was in the bathroom. Smashed, I'm sure. And apparently I fell and hit my head. So I can kind of remember coming out of the bathroom and there was someone there and blood's coming out of my head. And I knew that my liver was shutting down because I knew that if I, just from being a nurse, like I'd cut my finger and it would bleed for hours. So my liver was shutting down. I had my blood couldn't clot. And so they said, you know, you need to go to the emergency room, get that stitched up and blah, blah, blah. And went to the emergency room and I had a massive brain bleed. So they rushed me into Boston, and I don't remember a lot about that. My husband, my kids got a phone call. They brought me into surgery, and I came out of surgery. And at that point, I think I still kind of had my family convinced it wasn't quite as bad as it really was. So they had me in the ICU, and I can remember hallucinating. And I kept saying to my kids, don't you see Simon Cowell? Don't you see Simon Cowell? And they're like, no, I think something's wrong. So they went out and got the nurse. They sent me for another CAT scan. And because of my liver function and the DTs, I had blood again. So they brought me to the OR. And when the surgeon was in the OR, they called out to my husband and they said, you know, there's just something not right with your wife here. You know, her blood is not red. It's like a brown tea color. There's something off. And my husband was like, I don't know. So he hung up the phone. I heard this all after. And so my kids said to him, Dad, do you think you need to tell him about her drinking? And so somehow they patched him back into the OR, and he said, I thought that maybe she had stopped drinking, but she's an alcoholic, and could that be it? And all of a sudden, the light bulbs went off, and I was like, okay, that makes sense. So I was in the ICU for, I don't know, a week or so. They had to take a piece of my scalp out, and I had to wear this helmet. My head was shaved, and I was on a ventilator for a week. And before this accident happened, I can remember going to bed every night and thinking, God, please let me wake up sober. Please let me wake up that I don't have to drink. And, of course, it never happened. I guess the 7 days that I was on the ventilator was very touch and go. They had the priest come in, and they were able to detox me, and they were able to take me off the ventilator. And what do you think my thought was the first thing? The first thing I remember was, what did I do with that bottle of Captain Morgan? So, in hindsight, I realized that it's not just about alcohol. I woke up what I prayed for. I woke up sober, right? I was all detoxed. I should have been good. Good, no more alcohol. I don't have it. I shouldn't want it. And yet that wasn't the case. My first thought again was about the booze. And so the whole time in the hospital, I'm thinking, where is my pocketbook? I know I had something in my pocketbook. I can't find my pocketbook. I've got this helmet on my head. I'm bald. And I'm looking for my booze. So, I think a lot of it's mumbo jumbo. And a lot they blamed on the head injury. But I think a lot was my anger at not being able to drink. My kids tell me now that, you were miserable. You were terrible to the nurses. You were ripping out all your IVs and your lines and Foley catheter. I suggest never take it out yourself. It was rough. And my kids say, you know, if you weren't a nurse, Mom, they would have killed you. They had me in 4-point restraints. I said, every day to them, I want to see the doctor's order because I know he has to renew it every 24 hours. And if you don't have an order, you're taking these things off. Like, I was just a miserable witch. So anyway, I think at that point, like, they had social services coming in to talk to me. And I know that at that point, I still didn't tell anybody the truth about my drinking. And the ambulance came. They were going to take me to, like, a physical rehab place because of a head injury. And I'm thinking, if I can get these guys to just make a quick stop at my house, then go to the rehab place, I can get something to drink. And that is like how sick this disease is. Because it made perfect sense to me. Can't you just stop off on Christy Murphy Drive on your way to the rehab place? I need to find something. They were like, lady, no, we can't do that. So anyway, I went to that, and then I came home, and my husband and my kids really were done with me. That they had gone through all this, and my husband, I think he wanted to throw me out, but again, I'm bald and this helmet on my head. You know, he said, you can stay in the house. But the stipulation is that I couldn't drive. You have to go to a meeting every day. We'll get you to a meeting and we'll bring you home. So for the first 3 months, I couldn't be trusted with money. I couldn't be trusted to drive. I couldn't be trusted. I didn't know if I had a marriage. I don't know if I had kids. I didn't know if I had a job. I didn't know anything. And they would drive me to a meeting, give me $1 to put in the bucket, and pick me up. And the whole time, I'm going to be honest with you guys, I was planning my next drink. I was thinking, as soon as I get money, as soon as I can drive, as soon as if I don't have this job, as soon as I get another job, I'm going to drink again. And so those first 3 months of going to an AA meeting, and I had gone to AA meetings before all this happened. Again, it was a good excuse to get out of the house and get booze. I'd go, I'm going to a meeting, stop, pour my Captain Morgan and my Diet Coke, sit in a meeting in a corner by myself, not speak, and I got my booze, and that was good. It was worth sitting through an hour of your bullshit to get my booze. So, I was about maybe 3 months sober, would go to meetings again, wouldn't talk to anybody. I made my kids drive me 3 towns over because I didn't want anybody to see me go to an AA meeting. Meanwhile, I was buying my booze. I didn't care about that when I was drinking. And finally, you know, my oldest daughter said, I'm done. I'm done. I'm done. I don't want to see you anymore. You can't see Cecilia anymore. And then she looked at me and she's crying and I'm literally just thinking, shut the hell up. I mean, really, that's who I was. And the thing is, I had turned into my mother, which was the one thing that I never thought I would. I never thought I would. And she looked at me and she's crying and she said, you know, I just can't believe you want to live this way. And I tell everybody, that was my moment. Like, it really was my moment that I said, why do I want to live this way? Like, I have got the booze out of my system. And I'm still the same or even more miserable than I was at the end of my drinking. I mean, it was a very dark place for those 3 months because I would not accept AA. I just wouldn't. And her just making that statement was like, whew. This is really like the crossroads for me. You know, I will definitely drink again, or I can really try it. And so that was kind of the turning point for me. And when I came into AA at that point, I was whooped. I knew that it wasn't just alcohol because I hadn't had a drink in 3 months, and I was still just as crazy as I was. So I started going to meetings every day on my own. I was able to get my license and drive again, and I joined a home group. And, you know, I can't say that I bought into AA right then, but I knew that I had to give it a real shot. And so in Massachusetts, they do it a little bit different. You have your home group, and then your home group goes out to other home groups during the week. And you go to, they call them commitments, and you all pile in a car and drive to the commitment. And however many people you are, you fill an hour and a half of time telling your stories. And so I would go on these commitments, and I was like, oh, my God, these people, I can't stand them. I'm in the car, and they're just laughing and talking about their drinking stuff, and they're smoking and just, you know, all this stuff. But what I found was they were just like me. Their stories were just the same. And in those car rides, they shared so many things with me that you probably wouldn't even share in a meeting, like a speaker's meeting or a commitment. You know, they would just tell me things that they had gone through, and it was like very intimate, you know, the things that we would talk about. And so I asked this woman, she had been, you know, talking to me, and we had been meeting, I didn't realize it, and I asked her to be my sponsor, and she said, well, I am your sponsor already. So, you know, she was really the one, she took me through the book, she kind of showed me really what a sober woman was. I had never had an idea. It was funny, when I first got sober and first started to get into AA, my middle daughter, who was a great soccer player in college, just a great soccer player, and she came home after her first year, after my accident happened in April, and it was like July or August, and she said to me, can I have my bank book? I want to go get a car. There's no money in her bank. What am I going to do? And, you know, I think on my feet. Where am I going to come up with $7,000 or what? I don't even remember what the figure was that was supposed to be in her bank. And I'm like, well, so I go to my husband. I'm like, I have to tell you something. She wants her bank book. There's no money in it. And he's like, you're on your own. Don't know what to tell you. Sorry. So I called my sponsor. I don't know if I thought she'd give me the money. I don't know what I thought. And I probably did, because I was very good at manipulating. And she was like, you have to tell her the truth. And when she first started as my sponsor, she said, there's two things. I don't want you to worry about anything else. These are the two things I want you to do or not do every day. I don't want you to drink, and I don't want you to lie. Well, not lying was just as hard as not drinking to me. I'm not going to... I cannot tell a lie. It was... I lied about everything. And so she was like, you have to go and tell her the truth. And I was like, I can't tell her. Help me. How can I get this money? And she's like, you cannot get the money. You need to tell her. And so this is in the middle of my conversation with my daughter. She's telling me this. I'm like, oh, hold on one second. And I go and call her. She didn't come back. And, you know, and I will tell you, I think it devastated her. But I think she knew that that was the first time I probably had told the truth about anything in a long, long time, you know. And what I found is, in the beginning of this really taking AA seriously, and I am so grateful every day that those first 90 days that I didn't drink, because I'm telling you the truth that if someone had put a bottle in front of me and I could have drank it, I would. There's no doubt in my mind. But what I found after I started coming to AA and getting a sponsor and doing the steps, the change with my family was amazing. And the thing is that, you know, the first 90 days I thought, look at me, I haven't drank in 90 days. You should all should be, you know. And I really had to learn what living amends was and how do I literally not drink and not lie every day to try to build that foundation back with them. I can remember at the end of my drinking, I would get up in the morning and take a drink, go into the bathroom, vomit it into the sink. The mirror was in front of me, and you know that feeling when you look in the mirror, the guilt and shame and just, and because I always loved my booze, I would think, what a waste of booze, Gail. You just puked that in the sink. What a waste. But as I got some sobriety and started working this program, and I think that was one of the most amazing things in my sobriety was in early sobriety that I could look in the mirror. I mean, literally look in the mirror. I could not. I was so, I couldn't, and to get up in the morning and brush my teeth and look in the mirror and have a clear conscience is, there's nothing like it. I was about a year and a half sober when we moved to Georgia. If you had ever told me when I first got sober, I would end up, you know, at the Howe place in Georgia on a Saturday morning, I would never have believed it. And, you know, God has led me these last 11 years just to amazing people, amazing places. And when we moved here, I was, you know, the first time I came to the Howe place, I was like, oh, my God, they don't do it right. They don't do commitments. What is this, how it works? We don't read how it works. What do you mean you don't have a chip for every month of sobriety? You know, just things like that. And what... I would call my sponsor back in Massachusetts, and she'd say, you got to get a sponsor. And I'd, no, I would be cheating on you if I got another sponsor. I can't do that. I don't lie, and I don't cheat. And, you know, I did eventually ask a woman to be my sponsor, and it transformed me. It really did. And the beauty, I think, of that was that I was able to learn when I moved here through her and through the meetings here that sobriety doesn't have to be the same for everybody. You know, everybody has their own journey. And I found that as well with, you know, God. When I found God, it really was a God that was my God. That really, you know, she said, Janet, my sponsor at Massachusetts, she said, I want you to find what you want your God to look like. You don't have to call it God, you can call it whatever you want, but find what you want. Who do you want in your corner all the time? Who's going to help you and guide you and that you'll listen to and that will be with you in your darkest nights or your darkest whatever, and know that that thing, person, whatever you want to call, is always with you. And I will tell you, I moved here in June, and my husband was still in Massachusetts waiting to sell the house, and my daughter at that point was in her last year of college. And in October, I broke my leg. And I was non-weight-bearing for 6 weeks. I couldn't drive. I couldn't... I was in a house that had no furniture. It was pretty dark for me. And I had my AA book, and I read my AA book every day. And it saved my life. I found there was a woman in the program that lived near me, and she would come and pick me up and take me to meetings. And I never had to rely so hard on my program as I did for those 9 months when he was still up in Massachusetts. And the funny thing is, I had done so much work while he was up here that I said to my sponsor at the time, you know, when he moved down here, I'm like, my God, Mario has changed so much. And she's like, really? He's changed? And the thing was that I had changed. I had really embraced this program, embraced this book, done the work on myself that I needed to do. You know, she said to me at the time, you've never been alone in your life. Maybe this is God's way, because I was like, why would God break my leg and blah, blah, blah. And she said, maybe this is God's way of teaching you how to be on your own and get to know yourself. And once I started looking at it that way, again, it was that whole transformation, you know. I will tell you that I have a life that I never, ever expected. I had about, 4 years ago, actually 4 years ago last week, my older sister is a drug addict, and when I got sober, our relationship, of course, changed a lot, and I didn't want to talk to her. You know, you know how it is. You can hear it in their voice. And one day I was talking to her on the phone. It was probably about 3 months before she died, and I thought, oh, I can't get off this effing phone. I cannot talk to you. I just can't take it. And I hung up the phone, and God put in my heart, you are asking more from her than she can give you. And you have to just accept what she's able to offer. And 3 months later, she was dead. But in those 3 months, every time she called, I talked to her. And I had no resentment to her. I had no anger. I was really able to... Thank you, Nate. I was really able to really just accept her. And I'm so grateful, because a week before she died, we were going up to Massachusetts. Her husband had just died from a drug overdose. And she said to me, you know, will you come to me? With me to his service. And I said, yeah, I'll go. And we made all these plans. And she overdosed a few days later. And that was really hard. But what I will tell you is I knew to come in here. And so the next day I came in on a Sunday morning, and I was so embarrassed. Like, I didn't want to share it. And I didn't want to say anything, and I was bawling my eyes out, like people would have known anyway, but I had to raise my hand and say, you know, I'm really hurting. I'm really hurting. I'm mad. I'm hurting. And I, you know, I would have people call me. And so what ended up happening was we went back to Massachusetts to do a service, not only for her husband, for her as well. And I had people call me and text me and check in on me. And I will tell you, throughout the whole time, I never, taking a drink never entered my mind. Never, ever. And then about a year later, I got a phone call about my brother that's 2 years older than me. Alcoholic, severe. He had known 12 years of sobriety and gone back out. And Connecticut police called me and said, we found your number in his file because you would call and make, have us do well checks on him. And someone reported an odor. And we're sorry to tell you that he passed away. And again, the first thing I thought was I have to go to a meeting. And it's not that I felt like drinking, but I know that if I don't do what I'm told in here, I will drink again. I have no doubt. And there's no coming back this time for me. I don't believe. You know, I don't want to know. I don't want to try it. I don't want to take a chance. And, you know, that was a rough year. I lost my sister. I lost my brother. And then 4 months later, my father-in-law, who was like my dad, right? I had been with him since I was 14. He taught me how to drive. He's the one, you know, he didn't speak a word of English, and he would just pat me on the back. And just, he's just an incredible man. And he had to get in the, he went in the hospital, in the intensive care unit. And for about 2.5 weeks, he kind of lingered. And then, you know, my husband had to make a decision, you know, to withdraw care. And the thing that I have found in sobriety, and especially with that experience, because I'll tell you, when my sister, my brother, myself, or any other alcoholic know, if you continue on, the ultimate outcome is death, right? And my father-in-law is 86. Like, I never thought he would die. Even the nurse said to me, he's 86. I said, I know, but I just never thought about it. But the thing that I am so grateful for with that experience is I was able to be for my husband the wife that I never, ever was, ever was. It was always about me, always about me. And even in sobriety, I would love to tell you that. It's not, but 9 times out of 10, it's all about me. And for my kids, you know, their grandfather was everything to them. And to be able to help them and be there for them was just amazing. It was amazing. You know, when I came in here, I never, I wanted not to drink. And what I have gotten is just so much more. It's not, you know, it's not the job I have. I mean, the things I have are because of AA, but it is that peace and serenity that I never thought I would have, and I never thought I was worthy of it. You know, I'm so grateful, and I'm so grateful for, you know, my higher power that I found that teaches me things. It always seems to be in hindsight, but again, I realize in hindsight what that God has been always there for me, and I just never opened up that door. I don't know. I don't know. I'm so grateful for this program, and I'm so grateful for the life that I have. I'm so grateful. They used to say all the time up in Massachusetts, you know, be thankful that you didn't get what you deserve, because I deserve it now, but for a lot of years I didn't deserve what I have now. You know, my relationship with my husband and my kids is just, it's just amazing. You know, I now have 6 granddaughters. My youngest daughter just told me last week she's pregnant. So the one with Crohn's who has been so sick is having a baby. And, you know, what I have found in my darkest times, and that year was particularly rough in my sobriety, you know, when everybody died. And what I have found is that I'm never alone. My God's always with me, and you guys are always with me. And what I love is when I go somewhere out there, or, you know, I'm working in the hospital and I see people I know from the program. It's kind of like God's just giving me that nudge, like, there you go. There's one of you, you know. I'm going to just close with one thing that I read this morning that really kind of sums up AA for me. It's on page 152. It says, yes, there is a substitute, and it's vastly more than that. It is a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus we find the fellowship, and so will you. Thank you.
Just a couple of things about Gail. I was there the day that you came back after your sister died, and I thought, my God, the strength that must have taken you to do that. And what an example. I thought, would I ever be able to do that? But you showed that it's possible, and you did do that. The other thing is that the day I went for my first surgery on my arm, I'm walking down the hall, like, crying, and I look over, and there's Gail. And I was like, oh, how special. And then I saw someone else from the program, too. So pretty cool. Anyway, after all that, Big Book Fifth Step Promises, page 75. We pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel that we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe.